This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. For a long time, we've thought of robots as something foreign, not really woven into our everyday experience. But now evidence is everywhere that robots are changing our lives and our economy, even if we don't realize it. Robots often pack our food, sew our clothes, and manufacture our computer chips. So where is all this going? And can you imagine, or in fact, do you see a robot working next to you? Joining me to answer some of these questions are Jim Baum, CEO of Symbotic, which does innovative robotics, and Mike Jennert, Director of the Robotics Engineering Program at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thanks for having us, Kara. It's great to be here.
Yes, thank you, Kara. It's great to be here.
So, Mike Jennert, let me start with you because you're in charge of a whole robotics program, training people to work with these robots. What is maybe the weirdest environment or area of business that you've seen a robot working in recently that you thought, gee, I don't know if I'd ever, I didn't know if that I'd ever see this happen?
Wow. You know, there's almost no area where I don't expect them to be. So, we know they're going to be in space, underwater. I guess I'm a little bit surprised at how fast they've been introduced into warehouses and distribution centers. But that's been a great market for them. And, you know, really happy to see automation playing a big role in keeping costs down.
So, Jim Baum, let me go to you here. A really good segue, because that's what Symbotic does. It sort of automates warehouses. And I think a lot of people don't realize, they may not see robots in their everyday life, but the clothes they wear, the food they eat may have been packed by robots, helped to be shipped out by robots. So how do you take, let's say, a grocery store warehouse, and I'm sure it's enormous, and how do you have robots running it, essentially, instead of people?
Well, it's actually a very challenging problem. And I think one of the things that people don't generally see when they go into the grocery store and they look at the aisles and the groceries that are in the aisles, beverages that are there, all of the different things, the produce that's there, the frozen food that's there. There is a tremendous set of machinery behind actually getting that stuff onto those shelves in the right quantities, at the right time, keeping those shelves stocked so that the products are there when people want to come buy them. And so behind all of that is this whole network of transportation and warehousing and logistics that move products from the manufacturers into warehouses through trucking and shipping processes and ultimately onto those store shelves. And so when you look at one of these warehouses, just to give you a sense of it, you might see a warehouse that's 1, 2, or even 3 million square feet in size. We work in warehouses that will move in excess of 1 million cases of dry groceries per week. So just think about it, 1 million cases of groceries moving through a warehouse per week to service stores throughout an area.
And how big is a case?
Oh, a case may be a package of a case of soda people would be familiar with, case of water. They're about that size, and they may have anywhere from, you know, 8 to 24 individual items in those cases.
Okay, so something you might pick up at the grocery store or Costco, like when you
exactly
want to get a bunch of them all together.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's what we ship to the grocery stores. And then you can just imagine when all that stuff comes into the back of the store, it's got to get put on the shelves, right? And it's got to get put on the right shelf at the right place. And so there are all kinds of complexities around making sure that those things show up at the grocery store in an order, just literally stacked up on pallets in a way that someone can easily put them on the shelves quickly and efficiently without disrupting the flow of commerce in that store. So there are a lot of challenges around this. And we've looked at this problem and come up with some robotic-oriented, innovative solutions to automating the warehouse side of that. And how is it that you take those goods as they come in from manufacturers and then send them back out on trucks into those grocery stores in the right sequence and the right order so that they can be easily put on those shelves.
Now, do we have robots at this point that can deal differently, let's say, with a soda can? If you think about what it takes to pick up I mean, we probably never think about it. But if you think about what it takes to pick up a soda can versus picking up a handful of lettuce or one of those packages of spinach that you might get, it's a very different touch. And we just automatically adjust. But robots are very different. Jim Baum, and then we'll go to Mike Jennard on this.
It's a fantastic question. You're right. And it's actually a source of a lot of research that's happening in the industry. And so how do you pick up a head of lettuce without damaging it versus how you pick up a case of soda or a case of water? Very, very different, right? The lettuce is refrigerated. The lettuce is wet. The lettuce may be wrapped in cellophane. The case of soda is more durable, right? It's stronger. It's heavier to lift up. And so there's a lot happening in the industry now around how you pick these things up, how you move them. And there are lots of, we call it end effector technologies, end effectors that are used on robots to do this. In the case of what we do at Symbotic, we primarily focus on the cases of groceries, and we pick them up very gently and move them. But to pick up an individual item or an individual, a head of lettuce or something, as you suggested, is a much harder problem in a place where there's a lot of research happening now.
And by the way, do your robots care whether the case is 10 pounds or 50 pounds?
They do not.
Okay.
No, our robots do not.
Okay. Mike Jenner, what are you seeing in terms of that touch, which is, we assume so much as humans that we can tell how heavy something is, if it's slippery, but robots are operating in a whole different sphere.
That's right. Well, the problem of how to pick up a soda can was solved about 25 years ago in a research lab, and it wasn't really practical, and you couldn't see a robot in the world do that, but now you can. But to make robots that can work on general kinds of objects like a soda can or a head of lettuce, it has to be able to sense what it's grabbing. So traditionally, robots had really very few sensors, and they would have a metal gripper, a little claw, almost like the robot from Lost in Space, right? Danger, Will Robinson. It's got these little claws, and it can't really sense what it's got. Well, there's new technology being developed in labs now that gives robots a much finer sense of touch. Mm. So this is still a ways away from being practical, but they can sense hundreds of contact points in their, I'll say, fingers, and can get a sense of, are they grabbing something round like a cup or a bottle or something squishy like a head of lettuce, and then adapt to that, and so combine sensing with manipulation. One of our faculty members, Eduardo Torres Jara, has been a leader in sensitive robotics. And that area isn't quite ripe yet, but I think it will be very soon.
Interesting, interesting. So when you look around, if you sort of back up from all this and you look at the robotics revolution, do you see it really changing the way that we live our lives, the way that we do business?
Oh, absolutely. I think we will see lots of applications. Every day I look around at jobs being done and think, we can get a robot to help with that, whether it's in construction. You've got folks who are up on tall buildings erecting steel. It's a pretty dangerous job. They've got hard hats on and they're awfully high off the ground. Yeah, you could have a robot help on one end of that girder, for example. Not there yet, but I'm sure it'll happen. So that's just one example of construction. I think other areas are military, which is a big spender on robots, and also healthcare and home care. People want to stay in their homes much longer. Right? You might need a little help around the kitchen, getting your coffee, tying your shoe. You don't want to have to go to a facility for elder people just because you can't drink your coffee. If you had a robot in the kitchen helping you out, well, you could stay where you are longer, be much happier.
We're talking about robots with CEO of Symbotic, Jim Baum, and Director of the Robotics Engineering Program at WPI, Mike Jennert. And Mike Jennert, let me come back to you on that. How close are we to having a robot that if you're older and, like you said, you're mostly okay living on your own, but there might be a few things that you need some help with. How close are we to having a robot who can live with you and help you with those tasks?
Well, we're not quite there. I think that's some years away till they're really in the home. You might see robots in elder care facilities before that, where they can supplement existing workers. But as they get cheaper, you know, you might afford one for your own house. So hard to say just when, but I think it'll happen.
I want to play a little clip from a very recent film, 2012 film, Robot and Frank, which imagines this robot that comes to live with an older man, very much along the lines of what you sketched out. Let's listen.
I brought you something.
Hi, Frank.
You have got to be kidding me. That thing is going to murder me in my sleep.
Somebody's going to murder you in your sleep. Frank, you need a project. Today we're going to start a garden.
I'm not gardening.
My program's goal is to improve your health.
I would rather die eating cheeseburgers than live off steamed cauliflower.
Jim Baum, CEO of Symbotic. Is this something that we may see in the near future, or is this not really how you think robots are going to impact our lives?
Well, I don't think this is how robots are going to impact our lives. I see robots, certly in the near future, much more affecting us with a number of these types of tasks that you see them performing today. You know, in our case at Symbotic, we are moving goods through a warehouse, right? We are picking up items and we are moving them from one place to another. We're doing it very efficiently. We're doing it low cost. We're doing it in ways that are helpful to the stores. Other applications you see of robotics today, pharmaceutical deliveries in hospitals, a very common application that you see. You see many applications, as Mike discussed, in military situations where you might want to send a device in, a robot in lieu of sending a human in, because it may be a dangerous circumstance,
right,
or a dangerous situation.
Defusing a bomb
or investigating a potentially hostile environment. I don't think that's quite what we're going to see in the near future, but I do agree that we will see them affecting our lives. I think in many cases in ways we don't realize. You know, the online commerce revolution that we've seen unfold is an area that's greatly affected by robots, right? And, you know, a lot of what happens in online commerce, it's all about once you click that buy button online, which is so easy to do, how does that thing actually show up at your front door, right? And it's a very complex process. It's a very expensive process. And it's a place that's both filled with automation and robotic technologies today and filled with more opportunities for automation and robotic applications today. So I think that's the kind of thing we're going to see.
You know, I was talking to two very young guys at MIT who started a clothing store, and they were saying that, you know, robotics is coming to clothing and to shoe manufacturing, that in a lot of ways, the way that we make our clothing and shoes, and I spoke to somebody from the company Under Armour, which a lot of people know, and he said a lot of the ways that we make these clothing and shoes, it's medieval. In a lot of ways, it's medieval, and you're just getting low-cost workers in China or India to make clothes in a way that they were made hundreds of years ago. Mike Jenner, do you see that kind of old way of manufacturing maybe disappearing?
Sure. And I think that the recent announcement by Rethink Robotics of their new Baxter robot is the tip of the iceberg for this technology. You know, 10 years ago, the iRobot Roomba came out, and this was vacuuming our floors.
Created by the same person who created Baxter, which we'll get to in a minute, yeah?
As a matter of fact, that's right. So we saw the first robots in our homes, and people pretty much accepted them. They did useful tasks, and they didn't get in the way too much, and they're kind of fun to watch. But you didn't interact with it a whole lot. So now we have this robot that can be used in factories, in warehouses, that's quite a bit more capable. And so now we have robots not underfoot, but in our workspaces. So that's going to change a lot of how we work. And you can imagine a smaller version in your home, in your office, doing other tasks. So I think we'll see a whole lot more robots in our environment and more of us in theirs.
Yeah, so I should say, Rodney Brooks, who created the Roomba and also created Baxter, this sort of humanoid robot that you're talking about, will actually be my guest next week at a live innovation hub at the Modern Theater. And if you're interested in tickets, it's wgbh.org/innovation hub. But one of the interesting things about Baxter is, that's right, you don't have to be a computer scientist to program it. You don't have to have any special education. You can buy this robot for this sort of one-time fee, pretty low cost, I think in the $30,000-ish range, and you can have it, and you can program it to do the repetitive, menial tasks that people in your company, let's say, don't want to do.
That's right. Those people, once they get introduced to the robot, learn very quickly how to instruct it. I don't even want to say program it. It's really you show it what to do, and it does it again and again and again. And it's adaptive, so if it's picking up a part to do an assembly, it can pick up that part in different orientations, different locations. So it's really got some good vision in it, and the human trainer, let's call him, or worker, just shows the robot how to do it, and the robot then learns from examples. So you're right, you don't need those skills, but now those people who were assembling stuff are going to be showing robots how to do it, and they can be more productive themselves with the help of those robots.
Okay, so this is a good place to talk a little bit about jobs here. So if we see increasingly factory floors or clothing manufacturers, if they are replacing the people who make that clothing with robots who are doing their sort of repetitive and sometimes menial and low-wage tasks, aren't we also entering into an area where a certain amount of jobs are going to be lost?
And I think we'll see a certain amount of jobs being created, too. And what's more is we've already seen that we can't compete with low-cost labor for a lot of manufacturing, textiles, shoes, right? But if a robot is doing all that work, that robot can do it just as well here as offshore. If it's doing it here, well, you also have all the other jobs, the sales, the marketing, the finance, the legal, all the infrastructure jobs and the engineering and design will still be here. So you could have many more jobs here because you've taken that low-wage robot and brought it here.
Now, Jim Baum, CEO of Symbotic, to be fair, this has sort of been in the works for a long time. There are a lot fewer bank tellers than there might be because most people just frankly go to ATMs, right? Anybody who's been to a CVS or a Walgreens or their local supermarket recently has noticed that there's a lot more lines. They're automated, right? There's nobody standing in those lines. So this has sort of been part. Robots doing menial tasks has been part of our landscape for a while, but it sounds like that's going to accelerate.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, as computer technology has sort of revolutionized so many parts of our lives, yes, we have been automating many of these tasks that are menial or non-complicated or don't require extensive skill sets. And we think about that a lot in our business, right? Because really, if you think about the business value proposition of installing robotics, why do you do it, right? You generally do it to improve productivity, to reduce costs, to improve quality. And so does that mean that there's a loss of the associated labor jobs whose tasks you are fulfilling with robots? And I think the answer to that is in many cases, yes, right? I mean, that's the reason people are doing. They're trying to reduce costs. But at the same time, I think it's very important to note the idea that on the flip side of this is Mike used a very good example of how we're creating jobs through the application of robotics. We have we've worked with a number of clients who have had a really interesting dilemma. In many cases, some of these jobs in the warehouse, they're not that desirable, right? And so the idea of standing in a location and picking up cases and stacking them on a pallet, it's very physical. It's a lot of work. They're long hours. It's a tough job. And we have customers who say to us, you know, our workforce is aging. We've never laid anybody off. We don't want to lay anybody off, but we can't find, and we can't find the new people coming up to fill these jobs over time. So we have to automate. So I think that's one example we're seeing where some of these jobs that we're asking robots to do are jobs that may not be that desirable going forward.
Now, but Mike Jennert, I wonder what you are seeing in training roboticists for a new era. We're certainly seeing, let's say, a robot or a computer like many people remember Watson from Jeopardy, who destroyed Ken Jennings, the longtime winner of Jeopardy. And in a lot of ways, and Watson, I should say, a lot of people think he was hooked up to the internet and could sort of Google things. He was not. He was self-contained, created by IBM. They'd been working very hard on him. And one of the things that Watson shows is that robots are making their way up the food chain. It may not just be dumb or repetitive or menial tasks that they're doing soon. In fact, I think Watson is already doing work in law firms, robots like Watson, doing certain kinds of basic research, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, that's a case where in law firms, there is just so much information to read in a case that no human can, you know, can tackle a really hard case. They need a small army of interns and junior lawyers to go read every document. Wow, that's not a whole lot of fun for those folks. On the other hand, if you can have technology like Watson go through that, you can have the people doing the higher value work. I think that's really important that we have people who do the higher value, higher skilled work. So Jim mentioned earlier use of robots in hospitals to make deliveries. Well, a nurse today will spend 30 to 40% of his or her time moving stuff around, bringing things to patients, blankets, food, medicines. That's not really highly skilled work, and you could imagine, and now we have technology that can do it, having a robot do those deliveries to the patient's bedside. Wow. So that frees up those trained people to do the really valuable stuff of actually nursing and not being a delivery person.
So that, it sounds to me then, like people have to make their way up the food chain. They have to become the trained people. They can't maybe rely on doing the unskilled labor anymore because there may be a robot who can do it much more cheaply, doesn't need health care, can do it more efficiently, quicker.
Well, I agree. So people will have to be well-educated and have more skill, but they'll be able to use those skills in more of the time. So there's some challenges with education, but I think we'll solve those.
Jim Baum, CEO of Symbotic, you work with robots every day. I think people still largely think of robots as something from TV shows and movies. But do you feel almost like you're at the cusp of, you know, the end of the buggies and the beginning of the assembly line cars, and maybe the people around you don't realize it quite yet?
Well, I think that's a great comment, right? I think that the normal or I gave you the typical view of what a robot is probably different for everybody, right? And for those of us in the robotics industry, we don't necessarily think of the things that you see in the sci-fi movies that, you know, that talk and interact in a very human kind of way. And it's interesting that Baxter has a fairly human-like form to it.
But his eyes follow you around as you move around.
Yeah, it's very interesting. But if you look at what most robots look like and how they behave today, they are complicated machines that are electrical, mechanical, and software and controls oriented, and they're really complex interactions of all of those disciplines, right? And in fact, even in our conversation today, you referred to Watson as a robot, right? That's an interesting referral because most people may think of Watson as a computer. And so where do the lines cross, right? And I think that's what's really fascinating about robotics. It is such a interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary set of challenges. And really in robotics, it all comes together, right? We have to solve all these hard computer science programs, all these hard mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, software engineering, and controls and theory problems to make these things perform the way we want them to perform. I do feel like we are at the beginning of the assembly line coming out of the buggies, because I feel like the industry is at a place now where many of the underpinnings have become available to make this technology applicable to many different areas. You know, we talk about things like sensor technology and computer algorithms. All of these things, vision technologies is another good example, navigational capabilities, all of these things are now becoming understood through years and years of hard research at great universities like WPI and many others. And we're now able to take those and apply them in ways so we can create these very creative kinds of robots. So, you know, if you look at our robots today, they don't look at all like a human, right? They look like a little cart, but they drive around very intelligently and they pick things up very intelligently. And that's this interaction of software and hardware.
And can they detect when something's in their way so they don't bump into it?
They can. Yeah, they know how to avoid one another and they know how to avoid, you know, physical things in buildings, and they use all kinds of sensing technology to understand their environment and to respond appropriately to it.
Now, let's talk about something that you touched on before, which is the idea, and so counterintuitive, of maybe bringing manufacturing back to America because of robots. Do you see that as a real possibility?
I sure do. I absolutely do. Even in our business at Symbotic, we're a very small company, but we're manufacturing our robots in Wilmington, Massachusetts, right? We do it right here. Why do we do it here? We do it here because we have access to the talent that we need, because we have access to be able to, you know, directly manage that process ourselves. And I think even as we go to scale, we'll continue to manufacture in North America. That's just our world. If you then look at the application of robotics to manufacturing, it's a very important idea that as we can automate some of these jobs where we can't compete on low-cost labor in other international locations, we could supplant that labor with the use of robotics for many of these tasks, for assembly, for testing, for all of the things that happen in a manufacturing line. And then we have all of the other job creation around that for all the supporting functions that run that company, that enterprise, or that organization. So I think it's a very real thing. I'm actually very excited about it because I have seen evidence as we've worked with our own partners in manufacturing our stuff of manufacturing jobs being accomplished here in the U.S. as opposed to sending them overseas. And you know, just one other point on that, as you think about overseas, while there's a labor advantage in many overseas markets, there's a significant transportation disadvantage, right? So if we're manufacturing something that weighs 200 pounds, halfway around the world, I've got to ship that back, and there's real cost associated with that. So I think there are a lot of things stacking up in our favor.
Mike Jenner, you know, as Jim Baum alludes to, for many years, and we've seen a lot of political discourse around this, people have been taking their companies to China, to Bangladesh, to Sri Lanka, because how can you compete with people who make just a few dollars a day? There's just no way to compete. Do you also think it's possible that manufacturing is going to come back to the U.S. because of robotics?
I think so. Not just the U.S., but this area in particular. And the reason is
that Northeast.
Greater Boston, the Northeast.
Interesting.
Because we have a pool of talent here that's unmatched anywhere. And the reason, of course, is we have these great universities that have been doing decades of research in robotics and other technologies, such as MIT, Harvard, BU, UMass Lowell and Amherst, WPI. So we have that workforce here, the engineers and scientists who are able to lead this robotics revolution. So when those jobs arise, this is where they're going to be. You look at the companies like Symbotic, like Kiva, like iRobot, Bluefin, JBridge, Vecna. It goes on and on. Kinetic, right? These all have their roots here because of that long investment in research that has given us an unparalleled level of expertise in robotics here.
But the jobs that come back, it sounds like they will be, you know, good, highly skilled, well-paying jobs, and there's not going to be nearly as many of them. If you were to move, let's say, a factory back from China, it sounds like you're talking about maybe a factory that would have 1,000 people in it moving to something that would have a lot of robots and not that many people, although the people would be considerably better compensated.
That's true on the production floor, but you still have people doing the sales, the marketing, the servicing, the finance, all those other jobs still take people, and the engineering and maintenance. So there may be fewer shop floor jobs, but there'll be lots of jobs that surround that, and those will also be good jobs for people.
Now, I'm interested in what both of you, but I'll start with you, Mike Jenner from WPI. What do you see on the education side? Do you get the sense that there are enough people who are ready for those jobs? Do we have a shortage problem, a pipeline problem? What are you seeing?
Well, many schools turn out great engineers. So some time ago, we saw that robotics would be a big and growing industry. And so we decided to launch our robotics engineering program. And this is the first robotics major in the country for undergraduates. And we've already had about 100 or so graduates to date, and they're getting jobs. The nice thing about this is that they are educated to understand robotics generally. Now, most robotics engineers have been trained in electrical or mechanical engineering or computer science or software engineering, and they don't always get the broad view of the problem. And we set out to educate engineers who are broadly aware of the whole system's problems, from requirements to actual design. And they've been in high demand at Symbotic and other companies. And I think this is the right kind of talent that we can produce that will lead that robotics revolution.
And Jim Baum, I'll ask you, from the industry side, is there griping within the industry? Like, we do not have enough educated people ready to do these jobs, or are you finding the people that you're needing?
No, I think we need more people. I'm actually very excited to be in the Boston area with Symbotic and hiring engineering people around robotics because of the talent pool that's here. We have a couple of things going for us in Boston. One is the educational infrastructure that Mike talked about. We have some of the best universities in the world here producing graduates who can help us. But at the same time, we also have a very good ecosystem of industry around robotics here. There are many companies in the Boston area, either early stage startups or more developed, established companies like iRobot, who are not only developing and creating jobs in this area, but they're also training the people in the practical applications of robotics. So one of the great things about the Boston area in robotics is that we have this great ecosystem of both industry and education that helps us. That said, yes, we need more. There are real opportunities here.
It'll be fascinating to see how much robotics becomes part of our lives. Mike Jenner, you mentioned before Vecna, a company that I have visited and interacted with some of the robots that they've already put in hospitals. So it'll be fascinating to see. We'll have you back in 10 years to see where robots are in our lives. We've been talking about how robots are changing the world from the workplace to the economy, and I've been speaking with Jim Baum, CEO of Symbotic, which does innovative robotics, and Mike Jenner, director of the Robotics Engineering Program at Worcester Polytechnic Institute. Thank you so much for a great conversation.
Thank you, Kara.
Thanks for having us, Kara.
And remember that you can join me for a discussion about how robots are changing our world with, among others, Rodney Brooks, who we mentioned and created Baxter, got some attention in the New York Times this week. And we're also going to be joined by Race Against the Machine author Andrew McAfee, who argues that the rise in robotics could affect jobs in all sorts of fields, from healthcare to law to Wall Street. That's a week from today at the Modern Theater in Boston. And you can learn more and get tickets at WGBH.org/innovation hub. And Callie Crossley, I see you're back in Studio 3.
Yeah, so Kara, I guess we should start worrying about when robots can't assimilate bias.
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Right now, I just need the Roomba. Well, that's what we're looking at anyway. Every election season we hear now how polarized our country is. So we're going to see if and how the media is playing a role in our great ideological divide. I'm Callie Crossley.
And I'm Kara Miller. This is Boston Public Radio.